Let me introduce you to a man whose name I know you know. His name is Steve Fawcett. It is safe to say that this guy is an extreme sports guy. He likes extremes. He likes to go to the top of the world. He likes to travel around the world. He was the first guy to go around the world in a hot air balloon back in 2002. He was the first person to solo around the world in an airplane in 2005. He has 115 world records and more testosterone than everyone listening to me right now. His autobiography is out now. It's called Chasing the Wind. Steve Fawcett, welcome to KMOX.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Pleasure to have you on here. Do you ever just sit down and watch TV?
Why, yes, I do. I sit down in the evening, watch the national news. It's very relaxing.
Well, I would think after an average day for you, is there such a thing as an average day for you?
Oh, I suppose there is. You know, I mean, I actually spend a lot of days just sitting at my desk and being on the phone, organizing my future projects.
Future projects. You've always got something you're thinking about. What's the next big Steve Fawcett adventure? Have you planned it yet?
The very next thing, I'm going to Argentina 2 weeks from now, and I'm going to try to fly a glider for the absolute speed record.
Which is?
250 kilometers an hour. What's that, about 160 miles an hour, around a 100-kilometer course. So that's pretty fast without a motor.
That would be the point.
You know, we've heard about your adventures, particularly because of the connections here in St. Louis. Tell me a little bit about when you're in a hot air balloon. You know, the title of the book is Chasing the Wind. I'm guessing that's the answer to the question I'm going to ask you here, but how the heck do you steer?
That's it, and I've only got the wind. And so we actually steer it by getting different wind directions. So the wind is slightly different directions at different altitudes. So I might climb 3,000 feet or descend 3,000 feet to get a slightly different wind direction. And if I can't get the wind direction I want, then I'm in a mess.
How do you know what the wind direction is at the various levels?
Meteorology is great these days. We have a weather model from the National Weather Service that will forecast for 7 days out what the wind directions will be at different altitudes and where a particle will move in that wind stream. So, yeah, I'm the particle.
And, you know, it's funny because you say meteorology is so good. You know, sometimes we get a 30% chance of showers as our forecast, and then we get hit by tremendous thunderstorms that do enormous amounts of damage. So meteorology is not an exact science. Is it for you when you're up there? Your life is literally on the line.
It's interesting. Some of these isolated things, I mean, thunderstorms are a very good risk, an example of things that cannot be forecast very well or where they hit. But the overall weather patterns are modeled and simulated. The general weather patterns are much more accurate than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It would have been very hard to do some of these things like flying a balloon around the world just because the winds weren't well enough known then.
I would also think that when you're basing your travel on the wind patterns, you've also got to be conscious of national borders. When you plan your route, there must be places on this planet that you do not want to fly over.
It was a big problem in my early attempts. You know, I made six attempts to fly around the world, and I was the first three were in the Northern Hemisphere, and there were countries that I absolutely could not go over. I could not go over Russia, Libya, North Korea, and China. Those countries absolutely would not grant permission, or at least in advance, and I had to hope I could come up with a flight plan that wouldn't cross those.
What would happen if you did?
They're different. In the case of Libya, I was afraid they might shoot at me. In the case of China, I was afraid that if I flew into China and that I could probably get across the country and they wouldn't shoot, but if I had to land, they'd throw me in prison.
Yeah.
That's a little dangerous.
I would think that none of those countries are countries that you want to have to land in.
That's true. It's every landing I did was an adventure in itself.
And is it different whether you're in a balloon or in something like the Global Flyer, where you flew an airplane all around the world, or is it just all the time you want to stay out of the airspace of those countries?
I had an advantage with the Global Flyer airplane because I could fly on regular airways, and I was treated like an airplane. And China, for example, I could get permission to fly over. And so I flew over China three times with a Global Flyer,
mm-hmm.
whereas it was you're absolutely not allowed to do it with a balloon.
Now, I know that when you take off, and in fact, the story starts here, the autobiography, Chasing the Wind, starts with your adventure of taking off on a very, very long runway and nearly not getting off that runway. And I know from people who fly for a living that taking off and landing obviously are the two most hazardous parts of that. Because you needed a long runway to take off and land the Global Flyer, what would have happened if you had a problem in flight and had to land it on a place where there wasn't a really long runway to put down on?
Oh, landing is not a problem because it doesn't require very much runway for landing, but it does require a runway. I have to make it to an airport.
Yeah.
It was just a takeoff, which was always forecast to be a long takeoff roll before I could get it off the ground because of the extreme fuel load that I was carrying.
Right.
And so I had a couple close calls as to whether I could get it off the runway, even when I was using the Space Shuttle runway, which is one of the longest, well, the longest runway in the country.
Yeah. But when you thought about emergency plans, you know, since you were so good at mapping out where you were going to go and all the rest of that sort of stuff, did you think to yourself, okay, if I have to ditch, I know there's an airport here, I know there's one here, I know there's one here, and those would all be long enough for me to land on? Is that part of...
Nope. It was no problem when I was flying over land because I knew I could reach an airport because the Global Flyer would glide for my altitude at 45,000 feet, or 50,000 feet, I could glide 400 miles without an engine.
Wow.
Wow.
And so I'd have quite a pick of runways. If I had lost my engine or had some other trouble over the oceans, 400 miles isn't enough.
No. the oceans are a little larger than that.
Yeah.
And when you're flying, what position are you in? You're not with your seat back in the fully upright and locked position and your tray table stowed. You're in a different position than we are, aren't you?
I'm in the Global Flyer. I was laying back like a race car driver. Yes, I was very much reclined, but still had good visibility.
That was designed by Burt Rutan, right?
Yes.
He is the guy who also worked on Spaceship One, and also his brother Dick and Jeannie Yeager were the ones who went up in Voyager and were the first to do a circumnavigation of the globe in an airplane. That was two. You, of course, were one. Talk to me a little bit about this guy who's a real aeronautical genius, Burt Rutan.
He has a vision, and he comes up with these ideas of very creative things that can be done. And then he has a small company where they can actually build these aircraft. And so he came to me 7 years ago and said, Steve, I've got two good ideas. And one of them was to build an airplane which could be flown solo around the world nonstop. And the other one was to build a spaceship which could go out and win the X Prize, that is, be the first private space flight. And I wanted to do the first solo flight around the world. Partly it was less expensive.
Uh-huh.
And but when I think back at that, he had such good ideas. I should have done both projects and done the space flight too. But at any rate, I did the one, and it really worked well. Because the airplane was designed, and when it came into testing, the airplane worked on its first test flight. You know, the test pilot flew it around for an hour, and no problems. So it's a very, very successful design.
And then once they get done testing it, okay, let's bring in Steve now, and he's going to take this thing for a slightly longer ride.
Yeah, I actually became the second test pilot. So I did the last third of the flight test program as a test pilot. So I had a little practice in the airplane before I went off on the big flight.
Steve, a listener named Alyssa just emailed me and said, please ask him the obvious question. I can't believe you haven't asked him yet. Where did he go to the bathroom?
I thought you might ask that.
When you're flying around the world, what do you do for that?
Well, you know, it's all peens really easy. I mean, you know, you just have bottles and stuff. And, but
you mean it's like taking a long car trip with the family and you're not going to stop and, all right, kids, here's the Tropicana bottle.
Yeah, but the other kind of relief is, that's a lot more complicated. So then I be careful what I'm eating for the 3 days before the flight. And then during the flight, I stay on a liquid diet. And so it minimizes the risk.
That's such a delicate explanation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there have to be times along the way where you get a little burble in your stomach and go, uh-oh.
Yeah, there was an occasion just like that. I'd gotten 2 days of this first flight. It was taking 3 days to get around the world. And I really had that urge. And I did have as a backup these hospital bags called... fecal containment bags.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started moving everything around, taking the clothes off and getting all organized. And it was so complicated. Yeah, I completely lost the urge.
The opportunity has passed. Okay, we'll just move on here. And are you able to sleep? Because none of these things, you know, you fly across this country, it could take you 6 hours. I don't know how many hours it took you to fly around the world, but it was longer than you would normally stay awake, right?
Yes, my first flight around the world was 67 hours.
Oh.
3 days. And, but to do a solo flight, that was one of the criteria. We had to have an autopilot designed into this airplane. So we had somebody develop an autopilot for us. And then I'm able to fly the airplane on autopilot, and then I have alarms on everything. You know, I have alarms on engine, you know, speeding up or changing angles, and also just a regular old timer. So I could set the timer, set all the alarms, and go to sleep. And on that first flight, sometimes I would sleep as much as 3 minutes.
I was going to say, how could you fall asleep when you're in the middle of that adventure? Yeah. I mean, I've been off on vacations and had things going on, and I'd get back to the room and I'd be so jazzed from whatever it was that I couldn't fall asleep for several hours. Here, you're still right in the middle of the flight. I can't imagine that you entered REM state at any point.
No, there's no possibility of that. But these little power naps actually are quite refreshing. For a while.
For a while.
Live that way, you'd really...
Well, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to rest up here while I take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk some more. The autobiography of Steve Fawcett is called Chasing the Wind. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. I'm Paul Harris here. I was talking with Steve Fawcett, the adventurer who went around the world in a balloon a few years ago. Last year, went around the world by himself in an airplane. Which sounds awfully good considering what I had to go through yesterday on my flight back from L.A. The flight was absolutely packed. Every seat was taken, and I was in the aisle seat next to a fat guy in the middle seat. And I'm not a small guy myself, and I think that there should be some sort of waiting system.
So for row?
So that we
you
can
two
have...
two big people, split up.
You know, just get the gross tonnage of whoever's on the plane and divide them evenly so I'm next to a small person and then a fat person and on and on and on. Steve, you never have that problem when you fly, do you?
Everybody thinks that my cockpit was really, really tight, but in fact, I could actually move my elbows and stretch my legs.
But you're not up there listening to your iPod while you're flying, are you, or surfing the web on your laptop?
No. I have one good thing about flying solo is that there's plenty to do, so you never get bored.
And you've got plenty of people to talk to, right? Your mission control people, are they in your ear the whole flight?
Yes. Yeah, so I had a satellite telephone, so I was staying in. Frequent touch with them. Had satellite email too.
Satellite email.
Ah, yes.
And were people on the ground asking you questions like, "Hey, how's it going, dude?"
Actually, I didn't use it very much, but it is a capability.
You know, whenever I fly, you get to that point where you can feel that you've begun your descent, and they come on with that announcement, and then you can feel the wheels coming down. And there's that, okay, whew, glad this thing's over, and you're excited. If you're going somewhere you want to go to, or even if you're coming home, you have that excitement about, okay, it's the end of the flight. For you, since you love being up there so much, even after 3 days, when you're starting your descent, is there excitement or disappointment that the whole thing is coming to an end?
Well, it's exciting. All kinds of things can go wrong when you're doing a descent. And I'm really focused on not making any mistakes at that point. And, yeah, I want to be on the ground.
You just want to get down and have it done with.
Yes, because I know that there's a lot of risk when you're changing what you're doing, you know, from flying straight and level to doing a descent. You're flying into warmer air, and you have to get, like on my first solo flight around the world, got down, and then I couldn't get the gear out.
You know, Steve, I've always wondered, because you've been described as a multimillionaire, I've always wondered what is more difficult, the planning of these adventures, the lining up the finances, because that is still a part of it for you, or telling your wife?
I've often been afraid to tell Peggy what I was going to do next.
She's not used to it yet. It's been 38 years, Steve.
Yeah.
You'd think by now she'd go, fine, I'll be out.
Yeah, I remember once I was planning to do another balloon flight. And I was watching CNN International one night, and they had it right there on CNN International that I was going to do another attempt to fly around the world. And I hadn't told Peggy yet.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
And fortunately, she wasn't sitting with me, so she didn't find out until the next month.
You kept it from her for a month?
Yes. It's, well, I didn't want her to be upset.
has she ever said to you, no, that's not going to work. We have theater tickets on that Saturday.
She has been insistent on some of these, that I come home for Thanksgiving and, you know, some of those things.
Why don't you take her along?
This isn't quite for her.
Is she a white knuckle flyer?
No. It's just, you know, not everybody wants to do adventures. And in fact, some people would be very worried up there.
I thought that I read one time that she wanted you to stop altogether. Has that ever been said to you?
Yes. I think she would still be very happy if I would stop doing these things.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve, have you ever come up with an idea or been presented with an idea that was too crazy for even you to try, that it was just too much trouble, but you really wanted to do it?
Oh, yes. For some reason or another, a lot of people come to me with these, you know, wild ideas. And, I guess I'm a logical candidate to take these projects on. And,
like, what have they asked you to do?
Some of them are just totally far out.
Like what?
Oh, it's, flying a blimp, you know, for example.
Uh-huh.
A new design of blimp, or a solar power airplane. Now, maybe these ideas aren't completely out of line, but they're ideas that I didn't accept. And many of these inventor ideas, the inventor thinks that they're really good ideas. They really think they've thought it through, but they haven't.
Yeah, if it's Bert Rutan, you know you can trust him. If it's Bert Simpson, you want to go, okay, you know what, get back to me after a couple of other guys who tried that. I was reading the book, and I was fascinated because all I knew you for was the balloon flights and the airplane flights, and I knew that you had also done some sailing, and you've done, in fact, a lot of that, and you've also done a lot of climbing. I did not know that you had competed in the Iditarod, the dog sled race across Alaska. This from a guy who never had a dog for a pet. How was that for you?
It was perhaps the most fascinating thing I've ever done. I mean, and it wasn't a natural for me here, you know, a Chicago businessman going up there to the Yukon and Alaska. And it was a 5-year project, you know, learning how to handle a dog team and doing shorter distance races and finally doing the Iditarod.
And when you're actually out there, it's, what is it, like 1,700 miles or something like that?
It's 1,165 miles.
1,165 miles on the back. Now, normally when you would fly, you would be, you know, if you're in your balloon, you've got your suit. If you're in your plane, you're surrounded by the plane. What kind of protection against the elements do you have on the Iditarod?
Big boots. some heavy coats. And, it gets cold out there.
Yeah.
It's not always cold. Sometimes there are places where it got up as warm as just below freezing, but other times it'd be 40 below zero and just bitter. You know, you have these problems with, I mean, not only are you getting cold, but the dogs get cold.
Sure.
And they aren't behaving themselves very well. I mean, they would rather just, once I had a lead dog, she was an old timer. You know, she'd done a lot of dog, led a lot of dog teams, and she knew what a good rest stop looked like.
Uh-huh.
And we'd be going down the trail, running along 12 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden, she'd lead the whole team over underneath this tree with deep snow. And I'd spend the next 15 minutes pulling the dogs back onto the trail.
She had her will and you had yours. And who eventually won out?
Yeah, actually, I think she won.
Uh-huh.
I finally gave up on her and a lot of the dogs in that team and went out and organized my own dog team. Of all new dogs who hadn't run the race for anybody else before.
So they were going to do it the Steve Fawcett way.
Yeah, so that way, because I put together the team, I was able to be accepted by them as being their master.
On the front cover of your book, Steve, it's you in your flight suit just outside the Virgin Atlantic Global Flyer. And I'm interested in your connection to Virgin Atlantic through another adventurer billionaire, Richard Branson. How did you two hook up?
It was first in St. Louis. He came to one of my launches at Busch Stadium to see me off. Actually, he obviously came there. He knew something about me and everything.
Yep.
But he didn't know what I looked like. And so, very, very interesting situation. We inflated the balloon and everything. And so I walked over to him. I was going to, and just started talking to him. I said, "It's very, very nice of you to be here." And then he went into this talk about how, "Oh, this Steve Fawcett's an amazing guy. He's doing this crazy thing. I can't believe he's so brave." And I realized that he didn't know who I was.
Ah.
And I said, "Oh, yeah, I am Steve Fawcett." And he, hit himself on the forehead. And all that was on being filmed for British television. It was a classic moment on British television that he didn't recognize the person he'd come over to meet.
And so you struck up a friendship there. And at one point in that friendship, did you say, "You know, I need sponsors"?
Well, the first part of it was when I lost my equipment on a balloon flight. He was still trying to be the first to fly around the world, and he wanted to get me on his team. And so since I didn't have equipment at the time, I flew with him, and we made an attempt to fly around the world together, and we made it halfway around and ditched near Hawaii. So that was the way it started. And then more recently, though, he was sailing with me, and we had sailed around the island of St. Martin in the Caribbean and set the record. And I proposed to him that he sponsor this global flyer, and a day later he had agreed to it, and
a partnership was born.
Yes.
Yeah. I have to go back to the Iditarod for one last thing here. In the book, you tell a story about meeting former President Bill Clinton, and when he learned that you had done the Iditarod, he said to you that he always wanted to do that. Now, I've heard lots of stories about Clinton, both good and bad, but I never knew that this guy wanted to drive a dog sled.
Well, then, and the next thing he said was, "And I still intend to do it." So when he was president of the United States, he actually intended to do the Iditarod dog sled race.
I wonder if the Secret Service talked him out of that.
I was wondering how that would work.
His wife.
No, Hillary probably said, "Fine, it's cold, you'll be okay. As long as you don't have any interns along for the ride, it'll be okay." Steve Fawcett's autobiography is called Chasing the Wind, a fascinating story about a fascinating guy with lots more adventures to go despite the entreaties of his wife, Peggy, right?
Yes.
Steve, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.